So, so far we've done lazy people, busy people, and if you're waiting for your section, crazy people, that's coming after tea. But now is the time for questions about the meditation for busy people. An easy meditation. The reason I call it easy, because it makes you feel at ease. Which is what Buddhist meditation is supposed to do. So, who's going to ask the first question? Any questions from upstairs? Again, get precedence. You know, I told them upstairs, they got much more delicious food upstairs than you did down here. Because heavenly realms, they got more pleasure. So, who's... You got a question? Yes.
You mentioned that a busy person should take 1 minute to every hour to meditate for 1 minute. So, in essence, does the meditation involve only breathing, breathing out as a way of relaxing the mind? That is, what you should do every day, every hour, even if you are not busy. Am I right with understanding
No, you're not that busy, so you should just maybe do 59 minutes every hour.
Sorry.
No, I think this was just a person who had a very demanding job, and he just could not walk away from his desk to do anything more than 1 minute. And so he used this as a skillful means. It was an example of what can be done if you are wise enough. And so he knew he couldn't actually get out of the office and sit in the corner. People would bother him. But he did know that when you close your eyes, sitting exactly where you are, no one knows what you're doing. So that was his way of escaping, not away from his desk, but inside his body and in his mind. A place of refuge inside. Now he was very, very demanding job. For those people who haven't got such demanding jobs, you have more time. And you find that by being still, you make time. By saying what you make time is like the 5 minutes you spend, say, in meditation, you get much more done more quickly afterwards. So maybe you're working for an hour afterwards. If you haven't had that break, an hour's work is not high quality, not very productive. If you've had the break, in 1 hour you get the equivalent of 2 hours normal work done. Have you ever noticed that, your efficiency and productivity? Now, I don't know why in business people don't look at that and the causes for increased productivity and efficiency. Instead they say work more. If you work longer hours, you get more done. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. You just rest, take a break, and then you get more done. So it's not just hours of work, it's quality of your work. And when you get tired, please take a break. Otherwise, you know, you'll make mistakes. I'm sure that's what that guy in Societe Generale did. Who lost how much? $7 billion for that bank? Probably working too long in front of the computer until his brain stuffed up and made big mistakes. Whole bank can almost go down. Just one stupid person who gets stressed out and can't see what they're doing. So remember to relax and have a clear mind. Then you can be far more effective and efficient. But if you've got a demanding job, I know you haven't. So you've got no excuse for spending more than 1 minute every hour on the job. And one of the reasons, why do people not meditate? It's one of the questions I would ask myself. Why is it that not more people meditate? And it's because they don't enjoy it. So if you know how to enjoy meditation, feel this beautiful relaxation, it feels so nice. Once people enjoy meditation, then they meditate more and more and more. And it's not something you go like going to the dentist. You know, thinking, oh, I've got to meditate today. I suppose I've got to do it. Get it out of the way as soon as possible. People do it and they love it. They enjoy it. Once you love and enjoy meditation, then now you know how to meditate. Yes.
When it comes to meditation, meditation, right? If we just do like relaxation, and not, you know, apply any fancy techniques that we can read from books and all that, does this development of our meditation practice come natural?
Yes. Great question. A simple answer. If you learn how to relax the body and relax the mind, does all the other effects of meditation happen naturally? They do. Meditation is a natural process. This is one of my favorite similes, and this is actually an original. I didn't get this from Ajahn Chah. You see this bottle of water here? Those in the front row, like Victor. I'm going to try and hold this bottle of water still. Is it still yet? I'll try harder. I'll concentrate. Is it still yet, Jinchai? I'll try harder. Come on. I might practice this for all my life. I'll never be able to hold this still. It's the nature of muscles in the arm always to move. It's not that I've got Parkinson's disease. I know I'm a mover and shaker in Buddhism, but not that way. But there is a very simple way to get this water to be absolutely still. And all I need to do is to put it down. When I first put it down, it moves more. It's the nature of water to do that. But all I need to do is to leave it alone, to let it go, to relax. Because I feel very relaxed now. And that water is still moving. Give it a few more seconds, and it will get more still than I could ever hold it. And that's how we develop deep meditation. If you try and make the mind still by holding it, it will never work. You'll always be agitating the mind. Thoughts, plans, memories, tension will always come up. Jinchai, look, that's almost absolutely still. There's no way I could ever hold that water that still. That's my mind in this simile. There's no way you can hold your mind still. Every time you try, you'll always make it move. If you just leave it alone, just relax. Leave it alone. Let it go. Be kind. Be gentle. And it gets very still all by itself. That's the way you meditate. And it goes deep. Which is why that when people learn how to let go and relax, they're in those very deep meditations which sometimes people get. Sometimes some of my lay disciples will get these jhanas. And I'm bored with asking this question, but first few times I asked them, what do you do special that time that you got into this very, very deep meditation state? The reason I don't ask the question anymore is because people always give the same answer. They say, for the first time I really let go. They really let go. They stopped trying. And that answer came back so many times. I said, yeah, of course. Now you know why people get into deep meditation. They finally figure out they've got to let go and wait. Relax. Soothe, ease, soften, expand. Be peaceful. Stop striving, struggling, and making your body and mind so tense. It feels good for the body. Hold the body up tight. Come on, sit up straight. That feels terrible, doesn't it? Stop it. Just relax now. Doesn't it feel much better? No, that last year, again, I always follow science, because I used to be a scientist. I was told when I started meditating that you've got to have a straight back. You know, they tell you, you put your legs together, straighten up your back. Last year, scientists, doctors came up and said, that is bad for your back. And actually, it felt it was bad. It felt so tight and tense. They said the best posture for your body is when you lean back about an angle of 20 degrees. Feels good, doesn't it? You have to have a support so you don't fall over. That's why your chairs, and most of you at the back, are leaning back about 20 degrees. You know why you're doing that? Because that is the most comfortable position of your body. And I said, why didn't these doctors tell me that years ago? We always think straight back is the best back, but it's not. 20 degrees back. Science tells us that's the most comfortable position. You know, I knew that, but I never believed it. I believed what my teachers said. instead of what my body said. Now you understand how to relax. Feel your body. See that way I sit all over the place. It feels good. So you relax, you're at ease. Because I'm a pretty relaxed monk, that's why I'm friendly. It's true, isn't it? You know, you do see some tight monks every now and again, so stiff, and it's just so hard to talk to. And sometimes so unfriendly, and you're afraid of even asking them a question. Your body language tells you a lot about what's going on in the person's mind. When you're just relaxed, it shows you've got a relaxed mind, you're peaceful, you're happy. When you're very tight and tense, it's usually you're afraid of something. So don't be tight and tense in your body. You relax the body and the mind will relax as well. Here we go. Ajahn Brahe, no questions from upstairs. Are you still up there? Bang. Yes, you're still up there. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, please send them down. As a follow-up of your insightful CD, How to Be Successful, and a resounding success of your lecture at the HR conference in April 2007 in the UK, would you consider extending your wisdom and compassion by writing a book on how to be successful in business for the world at large along the lines of opening the door of your heart? How to be successful in business, write a business book. Gee, there's so many people who do that, don't they? Different. A business book. The trouble with writing books is that it takes such a long time, and I'm afraid of writing books. Ever since that Zen monk, I think I put this in a foreword in one of those books, when I was a young Buddhist in London, the Zen monk came along and told me, anyone who writes a book will have to spend the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey. About 3 or 4 books, I've got about 28 lifetimes as a donkey to. No, I was only joking there, but now there are so many books already. There's so many menus, but not enough people are actually eating the food. So, you know, we've got one book is enough. Read that. And just, how many books do you need to read before you get enlightened? So he said, read the book of life, the book of your heart, the book of peace. That is the best book to read. And the best music is the music of silence. And the best possession is the possession of emptiness. So these are wonderful things. So yeah, maybe one day I'll do it when I get around to it. But I'm a lazy monk, as I already mentioned. Remind me. What is it the Buddhist approach to face cultural shock, i.e. going to a new country, changing jobs, etc.? Well, I always go to new countries all the time. But you know one thing which I found, no matter what country you go to, there's people to people. That's why somebody actually is, this was at that talk I gave a few days ago for the World Presidents Organization, these big executives. Because I was talking about what it was like being like a monk, first of all, in Western country. And, you know, in the West, number one, people aren't afraid to ask you tough questions. And number two, they're not Buddhist, so they don't respect you anyway. They want to sort of embarrass you. And somebody asked me, what was the most embarrassing question you were ever asked? And it's very clear, because I think I'd only gone to Australia maybe 1 or 2 years. And this one of the local schools wanted to have a talk on Buddhism. So I went along there to this school. It was like a government school, not a good school, in a very poor area. So many of the kids were extremely naughty. And this was like a group of 14-year-olds, you know, going through adolescence, being really cheeky. And after I gave my talk, any questions, a girl stood up and said, what's your question? And she said, do girls still turn you on? That was one of the toughest questions I've ever got. But that is, at this WPO thing. Now, one of these executives says, well, what's the answer? And I actually told very honestly that when I see a girl or a boy now, that girl, that boy, is a container. It's just a body. So when I see a beautiful girl or an ugly girl, a guy or whatever, it's very hard for me to see the girl bit anymore. And it's the girl bit will create the lust or turn you on. When I see like a young lady, I see that's just their body on the outside. That's their container. And I know underneath there, there's this wonderful being. And it's exactly the same as if I look at a man or a child, whether a Muslim, Christian or whatever. Because it's your body is the container of you. And I've trained myself not to see containers, but see contents. What's inside you? What's this actually body carrying inside? When I see what it's carrying, it's this human being, you know, who's afraid, you know, who you know, wants to find some peace, who wants to actually love and be loved, but sometimes doesn't know how to do it, or sometimes makes mistakes. Someone who wants to be valued, who wants to find peace, but sometimes gets confused and very hurt, even damaged sometimes. So when I see that human being inside, I see that also in the cats in my monastery or the kangaroos. The kangaroo body is a container. And inside is this being who's afraid of, you know, danger, who wants to just have a bit of fun and peace, wants to sleep and not be disturbed. We actually see what's inside the container of this different forms of beings. You can have enormous compassion and kindness. So, no, girls don't turn me on. People turn me on. Beings turn me on. With compassion, not with lust. And that's quite honest. Just to see a person, you feel this incredible wanting to serve. And want to be of help. So it's a container. If you just stop at container, you get lust. Really, oh, she's a very nice container. Oh, he's really hunky. Look at his muscles. But what's inside those muscles? Big, strong person. And it's just really softy inside. You know that we have these motorbike gangs, Hell's Angels, over in Australia, Coffin Cheaters, they call themselves, God's Garbage, all these names they give themselves for these motorcycle gangs. And once, I have great fun being in the West, once there was a friend of mine who was a Buddhist, her son was in one of these gangs, and he killed himself on his motorbike. And he wasn't a Buddhist, but his mum was. And she asked me, can you come along to give me some support? So I said, yeah, I'll come along. I wasn't supposed to do their funeral service. And when I went inside, there's all these bikies, you know, with their leathers and tattoos. And really big, mean dudes, as they say. But even worse than that, you know, they're girls. This was in the middle of, it was a funeral. And they were like dressed like they were going to nightclub. In other words, there was more flesh and there were clothes on them. You know, almost like there were nothing on at all. But the mother decided she wanted to conduct the funeral herself for her son, but she just found she just could not do it. So I was just in the back trying to give her some support, and then she just choked up. She couldn't go on, and then she said, hang on, there's a professional in here. Ajahn Brahm, help! So I just came up and I just took over the funeral service. And these tough bikies, some of them are drug dealers, they came up afterwards, very nice service, sir. Yeah, very good service. Yeah, very lovely words you said, sir. They were just so respectful and kind and nice. And so, you know, they could beat other people up. But they always had this beautiful soft spot inside. When you saw their soft spot, oh, it was just so nice to see these people with these big macho tattoos and leather jackets. They looked, they were really mean. But inside, they were just so soft. And that's why I never see containers anymore. They're, you know, their tattoos, you know, their fashion and their piercings and their, you know, big leather jackets saying kill the police or whatever. That was just their, you know, just doing their thing. They wouldn't kill the police. But inside, when you don't stop looking at the containers, looking at the contents, there's some wonderful things inside. That's why I never look at the outside. Look at the inside. And then there's no difference between being Chinese, being Malay, being African, being Caucasian. That's just containers. Contents, the same. That makes sense? Okay, next question here. Do you personally buy the idea on what was performed on Bob Dent by a speaker at the 4th Global Conference on Buddhism in Perth in 2006 in the euthanasia debate? It is against the very teachings of the Buddha on karma. Thank you. The Buddha taught a lot on karma, but the Buddha also taught that karma is so complicated, so complex. I mentioned this morning. Only the Buddhas can fully understand the law of karma. Basically, it's such a difficult issue. And so, first of all, what the Bob Dent did was not talked about by the Buddha. Some of the things the Buddha said were pointing in that direction, but didn't go far enough to give a judgment. So basically, you can't really just look at a Buddhist text and say that was good, that was bad, that was good karma or bad karma. Just you can't do that. There's too many things in life just do not fit the texts. All the text can do is to give us some idea of how to proceed and form a wise, informed, compassionate judgment if we have to judge at all. So that when I looked at Bob Dent's case and other cases since, euthanasia happens in Malaysia. It's just not admitted to. I don't know if there's any nurses or doctors here, but I'm sure this has happened in Malaysia, that sometimes the nurse has given that extra bit of morphine, knowing it will kill that patient, because out of compassion for that patient, what they think is compassion, they don't want to see that patient suffer. They'll do that, and they are doing that, and doctors do that. Is that bad? Killing is supposed to be bad. But one of the cases which really made me stop and think, again, when I was visiting my mother, I was watching the TV with her to keep her company, the news, nothing sort of racy, not just the news. And that was fascinating because a snippet of news came up in a hospital, I think it was in Swansea. There was a woman who had two fetuses in her womb. And it was some rare complication, but it was absolutely 100% sure that if the doctor did not intervene, then both babies would die and so would the mother. The alternative, and there was only one other alternative, was to abort one of the fetuses, to kill one of the children growing up in the womb, and then the other child and the woman would certainly survive. And it was such a clear decision. It was black and white. And but because it was a moral problem, it got talked about in the news and had all these people from different religions, not Buddhist religions, all saying what you should do. And I was fascinated to hear these arguments. And unfortunately, before the debate really got interesting, the next day they found out the doctor had already made the decision and aborted one of the fetuses so the mother and the other one could live. But I ask this question of you. If you were that doctor and you had responsibility or duty of care on that woman, and she had two fetuses in her womb, would you perform that abortion as a Buddhist? I can put, as a monk I can't do this, but if I was a lay doctor, I would. I had a choice between killing one or killing three. And don't think that doing nothing is not karma. If you have an opportunity to help and you do nothing and you don't do it, that is unskillful karma. Non-action is as bad as action sometimes. That's certainly in our laws of our country. If somebody is injured and you just walk past them, and you don't offer any assistance, I think you could be, in certain situations, subject to breaking the law. And you, it's a moral outrage not to help people when they're sick or injured. Now you can see how complicated these precepts are. However, these are only in those areas, the grey areas of precepts. Most areas it's very simple. You know, you don't take alcohol, you don't go with another person's wife. Those are the simple ones. However, there's always these interesting grey areas. That's why the Buddha said, only Buddhas can really understand that law of karma. So, I say that this is what I would do. I thought Mr. Dent probably did the right thing, but I could be wrong. Because that's such a complex area of karma that I would actually defer to the Buddha. But if that's what you decide, then I would always support you. This is complex areas. But instead of putting all the focus on the complex areas, focus on the easy areas. Don't go around sort of killing animals or killing people like they do in the United States with all these school shootings. At least you know that's bad karma, that's quite clear. You know certainly it's bad karma to steal or to commit adultery. It's bad karma to lie. So get those very clear black and white karmas pure first of all. And those things on the edge like euthanasia, they're interesting. But the very worst case, it's only small bad karma, tiny bad karma. There's many worse things you do in life than that. That's why I don't judge people like Mr. Dent. So anyway, that's a very interesting but very deep question. But when I mentioned about the abortion, I've asked that question to many people. Two kids in a womb, mother, and it was so clear, you bought one, the other two survive. Do nothing, all three die. What would you do? Most people say, if they were the doctor, that's what they would do. Makes you think more deeply. Okay, next question. Please let me know where to get an English textbook on the teachings of the 12 causal coexistence, starting with ignorance and ending with old age and death. Can Venerable share with us the importance of knowing it? I know I'm fascinating with Buddhism in Malaysia because you get so much textual information. Now you're very privileged in your knowledge of suttas and the knowledge of Buddhism and the amount of books and the courses available to you. Does it really help? Does it keep your marriages together, stop you getting angry, lower your stress levels? Most important to know this because sometimes we spend so much time studying and hardly any time practicing. And it's the practicing, to put what you know into practice. It's okay knowing some theory, but the theory has to be taken with the practice. And the practice, they're talking about the 12 links of dependent origination. I know these things. I recite them in Pali if you want. I wrote articles about these, the scholarly ones, but now, sometimes that's a bit of fun and games if you're a scholar, but to actually understand it deeply, dependent origination is all about how you can get reborn, how you can have reincarnation without a soul. Because this is a question people ask. Buddhists believe in reincarnation, but there's a soul, so what gets reincarnated? How does that whole process work from life to life? What's the connection? And that's what dependent origination is supposed to teach you. And so I take all those links, you know, just push them all together and simplify it. If you want to, like we're building my Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. How will you get there? You need two reasons, two causes to get to my retreat center over in Australia. Number one, you want to go there. Number two, you have the means to get there. Passport, air ticket, visa. If you have the means and you want to get there, you will get there. If you have the means, you've got the money, but you don't want to get there, you'll never get there. Or if you want to get there, but you've got no money, again you won't get there. You have to have both, the wanting and the means. In dependent origination, the wanting to get reborn in this realm or that realm is called craving. The means is called karma. So if you want to get, say, reborn again, you know, as a human being, number one, you have to want to be a human being. And number two, you have to have the karmic causes for human rebirth. If you want to go to heaven, you have to want to go there. You have to have the karmic causes for that. And don't think that, well, everybody wants to go to heaven. Of course you don't. Sometimes you want to come back because, you know, your friends and loved ones are here. People in Australia, sometimes they're very stupid. They've told me in their next life they want to be reborn as a dog. They said that. I say, come, why do you want to be reborn as a dog? And they say, because then I don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. I can lay around and sleep all day. And the only job I have to do is let people stroke me. It's a great life as a dog, especially in Western country. You don't have to worry about anything, do you? You get food all the time, really nice food in the West. And if you're a really good dog and get a good rebirth in a rich person's house, if you've seen the newspapers, you can actually inherit millions of dollars. You can be, as a dog, you can be even richer than anyone in this room. But then I tell people, look, if you get reborn as a dog, one of the first things they'll do to you is take you to the vet. And you know what happens there. And when they hear that, they say, I don't want to be a dog. I don't want to get castrated or my tubes tied up. So be careful what you want. But that's basically dependent origination. Now the craving and the karma, that's what determines your rebirth. And sometimes, how do you get reborn in hell? Who would want to get reborn in hell? Anyone who feels guilty. Any psychologist here would know that people who have powerful guilt feel they don't deserve happiness. And it's called self-harm, self-punishment. You send yourself to hell. Look at people like Britney Spears, sending herself to hell. Crazy sometimes, some people. But that's because that's where we think we belong. That's where we go. It's craving again. Craving is not always for happiness. Many people actually crave pain and punishment. It's usually guilt, lack of self-esteem. Why some young girls in the West, they cut themselves. Self-harm. People do that and send themselves to hell because that's what they think where they belong. Craving is a very complex thing. And craving and the karma go together. And you can send yourself to any realm of existence. And that's what dependent origination is all about. Now when I explain it like that, you can see it makes sense. You can understand it more deeply. Which is why I'd like to explain it this way first. Understand it deep down. Understand its essence first. And then read the book. And then all these terms, you get to understand how they all work together. And no longer is it scholastic. It is actually experiential. And that's what Buddhism was always meant to be. The experiential, ehi pasiko, pachatang weditabo winyuhi, to be seen each wise person for themselves. To be seen in here. And then look to the books afterwards. Anyone want to comment on that? Okay, quickly. Done that one. What is the Buddhist approach to face cultural shock? Did I finish that one? You did? Okay, yeah. Okay, that's right. Seeing everybody is the same. How do we tame a rebellious mind through meditation? You don't tame your mind, you control freak. You make peace with your mind. This is a classic story. I'm sure you've heard these stories before, but in context, sometimes they hit home at last. Monastery over in northeast Thailand, where I was maybe 3 or 4 years as a monk. Many people who know the rural areas, water buffalo were used to plow the fields, to graze, their dung was used as fertilizer. They were so important They used to pull the carts. They're an important part of a person's family. And so during the dry season, people would really look after their water buffalo. They would lead them out from the village into the fields to graze. So they tie a string around the neck and gently lead the water buffalo out to the fields. The water buffalo are usually very docile animals. But every now and again, they get scared. And at this particular time, this man was walking his water buffalo just outside our monastery. Water buffalo got scared and started to run off. And this stupid man tried to stop the water buffalo. Which is stronger, a water buffalo or a man? And what happened was, as he was trying to stop the water buffalo, the string wound around his finger and pulled the finger off. Just the top of the finger. So this man came into our monastery with like a bit of bone sticking out and blood all over his hand. It wasn't a sort of a dangerous injury, it just looked a bit gross. But we took him to the hospital and we got him patched up, and he just had one finger shorter than the other. That was all in the end. But we used that as an example for meditation. Sometimes your mind is as strong as a water buffalo. When it wants to run away, let it. Don't try and fight your water buffalo rebellious mind. If you do, it'll pull many fingers off. Now what that man should have done was just let the water buffalo run away. It only runs 100, 200 meters down the road. And then it calms down. You walk after it and put it back again. The rebellious mind does not last very long as you don't feed it. You let it go. And soon it stops, and you can put it in again. I told that story once too. And that was actually, there's a lady, she's one of the Singaporean Buddhist Fellowship counselors. So she came to my monastery to stay for a while. And she had the rebellious mind. She just couldn't stop her mind thinking. There's nothing else to do in the monastery except meditate. So she came to see me and said, "Look, I'm just thinking all the time. It's driving me crazy. What should I do?" I told her that story. And also I told her another story about one of the disciples in Perth who had a rebellious daughter, 6 years old. And the daughter said, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I want to leave home." Now this, only six. Now this mother was a very wise meditator. I really admire her sort of wisdom and understanding of human psychology. So when her six-year-old said she wanted to leave home, mother said, "Oh, that's okay, fine, I'll come and help you pack." So the two of them went into the kid's bedroom and they got a little case out and packed her with all, you know, her dolls and teddy bears and a couple of chains of clothes. And said, "Mother," said, "wait a lot, I'll make you some sandwiches first of all." So he's made the favourite sandwiches for the child, and the child, so the mother was at the entrance of the house, at the door, and waved her child off, "Have a nice life." And the little six-year-old, carrying her sandwiches in her bag, walked out away from home. She reached the end of the street, maybe 50 meters, and by that time, the little six-year-old was already homesick. She turned around and walked right back into her mother's waiting arms. What do you expect a six-year-old to do? And when I told that story, this Singaporean girl, this Chinese girl, she was falling over, laughing, holding her tummy. She couldn't help herself. And I said, "This is a temple. Behave yourself." She said, I can't stop it. I said, "Why? What are you laughing for?" She said, "The same thing happened to me when I was 5 or 6. Over in Singapore, one of the big HDB flats, she had an argument with her mother, and she said, 'I'm leaving home.' And her mother, I don't know who the mother is, but again, she's a very smart girl, said, 'Okay, darling,' helped her pack, but in Singapore, she didn't have time to make sandwiches. She gave her $20 for her lunch." So their little kid with a bag and $20 went to the elevator, the lift, and sort of went down. And as the doors closed, the mother waved her off. And of course, she got to the bottom, to ground floor, and by that time she was homesick. So pressed the floor where she lived. And her mother was actually waiting for her when the lift opened. Sort of they hugged and kissed again. Now, isn't that beautiful psychology? The child won't go far. than a 5 or 6 year old, if you let it go, it comes back very quickly. And that's exactly what you do with the mind. 16 year old, well, 6, they're going to go anyway. Bye bye, have a nice life, but don't give them $20, they won't last 5 minutes. But for that, it was great psychology. And that's exactly how you use your mind as well. If your mind is rebellious and wants to run off, pack its bags, give it $20 and say, have a nice time, mind, I'm fed up with you anyway. And then it only goes so far, it comes back in, because you're relaxing. Why do people want to run away anyway? Why are you rebellious? Because no one's being kind to you. If you're kind to your mind is kind to you. Give a little bit of loving kindness and the mind wants to stay with you. That's how it works. So that's how you tame the mind. With wisdom, with compassion, you don't tame a rebellious mind through willpower. If you try willpower, you just get more stuffed up. Oh, this is interesting. Look at this question. People will really wake up. Recently, there was this sex scandal in Hong Kong. You interested? Human nature, they love scandals, especially sex scandals. And some obscene photos being circulated on the internet. Is this wrong to view these photos? How do you know? I'm going to check the writing on this. Have you got the registration form so I can compare? So find. That's an actually interesting question, isn't it? Is that going against the precepts? It's certainly unskillful in the sense of, you know, why do you want to watch those obscene photos for? You know, just maybe gives you a moment of pleasure, maybe, but not really nice pleasure. So what do you want to do it for anyway? So is it wrong? I wouldn't say right or wrong, I'd say it's just unwise. What are you doing it for? Haven't you got anything better to do with your life? People say they're so busy. How come you have time to watch that sort of stuff? There's a certain amount of pleasure in doing something which is wrong. Just being naughty, that's all. You get a bit sort of excited, you know, just doing something which is a bit sort of unallowed. But then afterwards, you should grow up out of that and say, yeah, and the reason it's not allowed, the reason it's called obscene, it's a scandal, there must be some reason for it. No, and the reason is, you know, it's just inciting some emotions and some feelings inside of you, which may lead to other, even more worse things. I don't know if it's been proved yet, but people often say just, you know, the violence on the internet, the pornography on the internet, leads, you know, to more sexual crimes in the community. And there might be that. There might be that. I don't mean to like to be a prude, but, you know, as long as it's not going to have a deleterious effect on people's behaviour, I can't see anything wrong with it. But if it's really going to harm, make people more violent, maybe increase rapes or sexual exploitation, I don't think that's a good thing to do. So I don't know what the obscene photos are. I haven't looked at them. But if it's really creating problems and difficulties, then give it up, stop doing it. Instead, you know, I'm on YouTube. You can watch monks on YouTube instead of, you know, porn on YouTube. Dharma is much more powerful than obscene. So that's a really weird question. And I promise, actually, I will not compare your handwriting and find out who it is. You are completely safe. So these are ways. Any other questions before we finish off for tea? It's supposed to be at 2:45 for a tea break. Yeah, last, yes? Daily meditation schedule. It's uncertain, always changes, never one day the same. Basically, because you know, I have to adapt to all sorts of different things. Because you know, when you're a boss, you know, like you're the clearing house, and so if anything goes wrong, I have to fix it or at least talk to people. So my meditation is basically being in the moment, and if there's someone in front of me, then I will care for you and give all my attention to you. If no one is in front of me, I'll close my eyes and just be still and peaceful. That's my meditation. And I always make sure that every year, usually in these days in August or no, September, I'd usually spend 2 months in my cave. I don't come out. 2 weeks, sorry. It'd be great if it was 2 months. That must be wishful thinking. And that time I'd tell all the other monks and lay people around, I don't care what happens. If all you monks fall in love or go and watch obscene pictures on the internet, it's none of my business. Do what you want. Don't bother me for 2 weeks. So that's actually what I do. For 2 weeks, then I just stay in my hut and just meditate all day. And most of the night as well. That's my sort of little time off. And I don't need to go to a holiday camp or a resort. My resort's inside. So I just close the door and just go inside. So that's actually my life. I like teaching meditation retreats simply because that's the time when everyone else is meditating and I'm meditating as well. So I also get some much more time for meditation when I teach retreats. When you come to like Malaysia this time, I give myself completely to you guys. To teach, talk as much as you want. But they don't have to worry because when I go back, I'm much quieter. So I don't have a schedule. Much nicer that way, because you don't have to think, oh, I've got to get up this morning. Oh, I've missed my meditation. That's not fair. No, just keep it smooth, keep it loose. There's plenty of time to meditate. That makes sense? Okay, it's 2:45. So now is tea meditation, where you can all have some vitamin C, vitamin caffeine, if you want to wake up. So I think there's things to eat as well. It's only supposed to be a 15-minute break, but I can't see that finishing eating in 15 minutes. Where we had lunch upstairs, and I started my lunch, what is it, 11:30. I was finished by about 10 to 12. And then afterwards I invited everybody else to have their lunch. And they started about 12. They were still in there about 1:05. So I can't see how you're going to finish in 50 minutes, but give it a try anyway. So have some tea, have a bit of something to eat, and we'll come back when we're ready. So maybe about 3 o'clock, maybe 3:15, see what happens. So relax to the max and have a nice cup of tea or something to eat. Okay? And upstairs as well, hopefully you've got some more heavenly food up there and even more delicious tea than we have. Thank you very much for banging your feet again, but not too hard, otherwise the floor will come in. Okay. Very good.